Culture. I want to thank the producer, Kim Wheeler, for asking me to be a part of it, as well as all those good people at the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Next week, my colleague, Christine Janier, will be here to introduce you to her language of South Tushone, along with other languages in the Athabaskan family. Remember to visit our website at www.wordsandculture.ca for more information and language learning. I'm Michael Hutchinson. Be well. Keep smiling.
Words and Culture is made possible with funding from SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Words and Culture is produced by Kim Wheeler. Kaylin Belair is our audio engineer and editor.
Onigiwahi.
Gigawabamin. Soko seni denit e. Nina nyuji hina.
Echo say.
Kakuhutau. We'll see you again.
Hello, welcome to this edition of Viewpoints. We start a new year with feel-good stories, as we should, and with Canadians that make a difference locally and at the national level. Was volunteering locally on your New Year's resolution list? We'll meet up with some people for whom it was.
I needed a purpose. I needed to belong somewhere. I needed to be part of a group.
To Montreal, Quebec, where a senior center provides support for youth caregivers. There are more than 1 million of them across the country.
They don't consider themselves to be caregivers, so there's no discussion, there's no communication, so there's no support.
The Dimensions Retreat Center helps Canadian veterans cope with PTSD.
Well, alcohol and pills and everything took over my life. Rehab got me on the way to everything. It got me off the booze, off the pills and everything. But a lot of the work happens after, putting the time in for yourself.
History is made in BC. The Comox First Nation appoints its first Justice of the Peace. Dr. Marion Buller leads this journey of self-governance.
Dr. Buller is a First Nation member of the Mistawasis Cree First Nation in Saskatchewan and has achieved much in her career over 22 years as a provincial judge. There's no doubt that they've made a perfect choice for their Justice of the Peace.
And we'll take to the ice and relive special moments between fans and curlers in the mixed doubles curling trials in Liverpool, Nova Scotia.
Austin.
Welcome to Viewpoints, local news nationwide.
You are on the air with Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
Welcome to this new year. Happy to have you with us to kick off 2025. My name is Boris Chassaigne. I'll be with you for the next half hour. Many of us have thought about our New Year's resolutions during the holidays. Yes, we had ours. Some of you might want to lose weight, read more, maybe travel, or do you wish to make a positive impact on your community and by volunteering maybe? Well, the Waterloo region has, for the past few years, been facing a decrease and volunteers and is looking for more. Could it be you? Kimberly Seed made the move. She's a volunteer driver for Family and Children's Services in Kitchener and spends a couple of hours every month doing so. Cora Cool, based in Kitchener, Waterloo, Ontario, spoke to several volunteers about why they give their time to others.
Waterloo Region is facing a decrease in volunteers since the pandemic, and organizations across the region are always looking for new volunteers. Volunteers like Kimberly Seed, who is a volunteer driver for Family and Children's Services in Kitchener, says the benefit of volunteering is the impact it has on the people directly.
It just feels good to be able to give back to your community. And even if you're doing one thing a week for an hour, or if it's once a month that you're volunteering your time, just being able to give back to whatever organization you're doing the volunteering with, that's part of being part of community, right? You live wherever you live, you pay your taxes, and you should also maybe give back a little bit if you can.
Seed has been volunteering for over a decade and leads a busy life outside volunteering. Seed says the impact is what keeps her going.
There's been a lot of different roles, and I think the different experiences and different kids that I've been able to interact with and just kind of seeing the impact it has just really keeps me going. Every time I'm like, oh, I'm just going to cut back a little bit, I'm like, well, I can't cut back on this because it's just too important.
Like Seed, Benita Lang, who is a volunteer with the House of Friendship, says she volunteers to give her purpose.
I retired in 2021 and I needed a purpose. I needed to belong somewhere. I needed to be part of a group. And so I was looking for something where I could volunteer.
Lang has been volunteering for many years with different organizations and says that she is grateful to be able to make positive impact on the community.
You look at the state of the world right now. Okay, globally, chaos. What am I going to do about it? I can't affect that. You look at it nationally, chaos. I can't do anything about that. So the only effect that I can have is locally in my own community. So I can be more effective on a smaller scale to improve my community, which then can improve provincially, which can then and expand that way.
Another volunteer, Richard Hack, who volunteers with Habitat for Humanity, says that he enjoys volunteering because it gives him something to do during his retirement.
I can't sit at home and look out the window, and I don't collect stamps, I don't collect coins, I don't watch TV, I don't go to the coffee clutch at Tim Hortons, you know, it's... I just need something to do.
Hack says something to remember when looking to volunteer is that many positions don't require special skills and anyone can do them.
I think the thing to remember is that it doesn't require any special skill. You know, it's stuff that anybody can do it. Even I do it. Things that require skill, like drywall mudding or plumbing or electrical, that's all done by people that are licensed or have the skill. But there's lots of jobs that don't require skills. And so don't be afraid to just come out and see what happens, you know.
All of these individuals volunteer for their own reasons, but make a huge impact on the community, adding something as simple as spending a couple hours a month volunteering to your New Year's resolutions will make a difference in the community. In Kitchener, with the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Cora Cool.
Some volunteers are caregivers. When that name pops up, the image that immediately comes to mind is often one of an older adult taking care of an aging family member. However, this is often not the case. Across Canada, 1.25 million caregivers are aged between 15 and 24 years old. The Eva Marsden Center, a senior support center in Montreal, Quebec, is bringing attention to providing support for those youth caregivers. The center says that they are an under-recognized group, but they're now able to drop in on the current caregiver support circle. Helena Wallace will be phasing into a youth-specific circle and support network where youth can receive guidance and connect with each other. Here's Adam Innes in Montreal, Quebec.
2 years ago, the center started a caregiver support circle, a gathering where those who care for seniors in their personal lives can come and get advice, share stories, and generally support each other. The program has been a success with regular attendance weekly. But Elena Wallace, the center's community outreach lead, noticed another demographic in need of this support.
I'm starting a focus on youth caregivers because that is a huge anomaly. There's so many young people that take care of older family members. And yeah, I just want to give space to them, offer the support that they get from other caregivers and be a source of information.
Across Canada, 1.25 million caregivers are between 15 to 24 years old. Wallace says she has seen here in Montreal West, a lot of youth caregivers are not able to recognize their importance.
A lot of time, too, it's ethno-cultural. It's not looked upon as a task. You know, I'm a caregiver. It's I need to do this for my mom or my dad or my brother or my sister. So it's just innating them. It's just a part of what they do. So that alone just speaks volumes. Like they don't... they just don't consider themselves as caregivers. But in fact, that's exactly what they are. They don't consider themselves to be caregivers, so there's no discussion, there's no communication, so there's no support.
Wallace says youth caregivers face a number of specific challenges due to their age.
That age group, they're usually going to school or writing exams or a number of things that teens tend to do. But if they're missing classes, a lot of the times they're having a hard time keeping up with the curriculum, or, you know, if you're in university, then it's the time management already in caregiving. Time is so precious.
Currently, youth caregivers are now able to drop in on current caregiver support circles at the Ava Marsden Center. But over this month, Wallace will be phasing in a youth-specific circle. Youth will receive guidance and connect with each other. Wallace says when it comes to caregiving, making a connection and having a chat can go a long way.
I think a huge aspect also of caregiving is having someone to listen to, like actively listening, and someone that can relate to what you're going through.
The center has also begun work on a phone line specific for youth caregivers and has been reaching out to local businesses to create programs where youth caregivers can enjoy reduced fees on certain fun services like nail appointments. The Ava Marsden Center hopes to launch these parts of the program in March. The full youth caregiver support circle starts later this January. For the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Adam Innes.
It's all about caring for others, isn't it? And that is exactly why the Dimensions Center in Haliburton County, Ontario is so important. Dimensions is a safe place for veterans in need of help to overcome PTSD. Dimensions has so far treated nearly 200 veterans and is planning to expand its programs to include first responders as well. There are some 630,000 veterans in Canada, and statistics reveal that they are prone to higher rates of depression and anxiety. The center is set on 42 acres of serene wilderness on Maple Lake. The facilities include 17 cabins, a lodge for clinical services, a float tank for deep relaxation, and a stunning geodesic dome. Journalist Elizabeth Oakley recently spoke with Scott Atkinson, a veteran whose life was dramatically changed at Dimensions. Also with the clinical psychotherapist that works with veterans to improve their quality of life and deal with their PTSD symptoms.
Scott Atkinson knows a lot about trauma and the many unhealthy ways to cope with it. Having served for 25 years in the military in war zones, Scott has seen and experienced unimaginable pain and turned to alcohol and painkillers to keep him numb. After years of a downward spiral, which cost him his 24-year marriage and family, Scott found Dimensions, an interdisciplinary treatment program in Haliburton County, specializing in post-traumatic stress disorder in Canada's military service men and women. The program, soon to be expanded to include police, fire, and EMTs, has already helped nearly 200 veterans like Scott turn their lives around.
No, alcohol and pills and everything took over my life a lot. And 2018, I ended up in rehab for 6 weeks, and it was the same there. Don't fix anything, just take pills and we'll put it there. I was on 22 pills a day when I came out of rehab. Rehab got me on the way to everything. It got me off the booze, off the pills and everything.
Scott served in Yugoslavia and did two tours in Afghanistan. The daily barrage of brutality fed into his fear and anger, and it took its toll.
To Afghanistan was a year long, you know. I was in the operations side of it, and it just feeds on your brain. It's like constant. It's like a giant video game in 24 hours a day. So, you know, it's hard to pinpoint and say what exactly did it was, you know. But it fed to the alcohol, the pills after, and everything. And that ultimately, that was nobody's fault but my own. But, you know, it's the way I was coping. It was the way I was dealing with the anger, the depression, you know. Every vet kind of works on the same way. You get that anxiety built in you, which leads to fear and anger, and then it leads to depression, because now you're like, well, what did I do? You know, my poor kids. Like I fight that every day now, the guilt of what my kids went through, and they're in their 20s now.
Eager to live a healthier life, Scott got his diabetes under control, began practicing yoga, and learned more about using therapeutic cannabis and psychedelics for trauma and pain management. His research led him to Dimensions, and soon, Scott was benefiting by the PTSD programs there. The program is divided between a 10-day retreat for vets, followed by a year-long follow-up program with Dimension staff and fellow participants. The goal is to support vets reintegrating with society.
You do the 10-day retreat up there with the veterans, and you learn so much. And if you do the hard work after, it's going to continue. It will continue for as long as you want it to. And I think that's a big part of the key. Like, there's the 10 days up there, which is fabulous up there. Like, you can't deny what it is up there. But a lot of the work happens after, in dealing, not, I shouldn't say dealing, in working with yourself and putting the time in for yourself.
Donald Curry is the clinical director of Dimensions and a registered psychotherapist. He says the veterans program is trauma-based in a secluded, natural setting. Using complementary practices such as somatic body-oriented therapy, sound baths, Thai massage, yoga, cold plunges, and even biosound therapy, the Dimensions team works together to address trauma stored in the body.
It is a very tailored approach for each person because each person is a unique individual, right? So the team collaborates together and coming up with, you know, the best treatment care plan that we can for someone. And it really is combining that modern neuroscience with the ancient wisdom, right? Of being in nature to heal, being in community. Like, we've healed in communities for thousands of years. And I think that we've become more disconnected over the past few decades. And so it's returning to that sense of community we see as helping people to heal. Oftentimes when you're working with a population, a clinical population like veterans, there's a higher level of trauma. Right. Oftentimes people that come in for a veteran program have complex PTSD symptoms, depression and anxiety. Everything that we do here is trauma informed. Right. So it's always talking. It's first of all about building a really safe and strong therapeutic relationship with the guests that come through here. It's also, you know, really talking about everything that we're going to do every step of the way and giving people agency and choice within the process as to what feels comfortable for them, what doesn't. And then we're able to make adjustments, right? And find the right cadence and the right rhythm within their therapeutic process that feels safe for them. We have saved people lives, I would say, you know. So it's great to see the progress of people and also like how in such a short time we're able to turn that around. It's really remarkable.
Meanwhile, back in Smith Falls, Scott is feeling positive about his progress, as well as his emotional and physical well-being. He is now a yoga instructor and a strong advocate for veterans' mental health. Dimensions is already working on programs for first responders and hopes to have them in place soon.
Thanks to Elizabeth Oakley in Haliburton, Ontario.
Hi, this is Erica Butler in Sackville, New Brunswick. You are tuned to Viewpoints.
Questions or comments? Our email is radio@frequencynews.ca. radio@frequencynews.ca.
From caring to being with others, we turn to sports and to Nova Scotia, where the 16 teams at the Canadian Mixed Doubles Curling Trials treated fans to some impressive curling last week in Liverpool. One young Queens County curler left his own impression on the father-daughter team of Jalen and Jim Cotter from Vernon, BC. 7-year-old Albie Randall led the Cotters onto the ice during the opening ceremonies last Sunday evening. He was one of the young curlers chosen to escort teams. The Cotters remembered Albie later in the week after their last game and gave him one of their curling brooms as a souvenir. Coincidentally, Albie's family had lived near Vernon before they moved to the Liverpool area. Rick Conrad in Liverpool, Nova Scotia was on location.
The 16 teams at the Canadian Mixed Doubles Curling Trials in Liverpool treated fans to a week of impressive curling. The trials wrapped up on Saturday at Queen's Place AmeriCentre. One young Queens County curler, though, left his own impression on the father-daughter team of Jalen and Jim Cotter from Vernon, BC. 7-year-old Albie Randall of Brooklyn led the Cotters onto the ice during the opening ceremonies last Sunday evening. He was one of the young curlers chosen to escort teams. The Cotters remembered Albie later in the week after their last game and gave him one of their curling brooms as a souvenir. Albie's father, Darren, explains.
Oh, the moment from the week that stuck with me is one of the Cotters, the team, when they went out of the tournament, my son walked down and they gave him their broom from the game, which is super emotional, which is, I never would have thought that from coming to a curling tournament. And we used to live near Vernon, BC, and it's where they was from also. It was just randomly that he was leading them out, like, hey, and yeah, and it was just great.
As for Albie, he summed up the experience in one word.
Awesome.
That was just one of the special moments from the week of curling in Liverpool as some of the country's top curlers competed for a chance to represent Canada at the 2026 Winter Olympics in Italy. Jocelyn Peterman and Brett Gallant capped their perfect record during the week by winning the final on Saturday over Rachel Homan and Brendan Botcher. After a year and a half of work getting it together, organizers were happy with how the week went. Kim Thorburn Whalen is the vice chair of the Liverpool Championship Host Society, which has hosted four major curling events in Liverpool. She said it's their biggest and most successful one yet.
It surpassed our expectations. Like, we had a budget for what we were looking for ticket sales, and we more than doubled it. So for the final weekend, it's been pretty well sold out, and this draw, the final draw today, has been sold out completely. So we're pretty ecstatic about that. It's been over 1,000 seats sold just for the final draw today.
Some longtime curling fans, like Rose Anthony of Milton, took in every moment.
It was fantastic. I had the whole package, and I never missed a draw.
The curling trials also created some new fans in Liverpool, like Albie's dad, Darren.
Learned so much. I never knew all the, like, I mean, still learning the rules, but great, so skillful, and I'm into it, and I'm like a soccer football guy myself, right? And I love this, so yeah, it's perfect.
Winners Peterman and Gallant will next compete at the World Mixed Doubles Curling Championships in Fredericton in April. I'm Rick Conrad.
Hello, I'm Candace Vetter in Embrim, Ontario, and you're tuned into Viewpoints.
And we close our show in British Columbia, where the Comox First Nation made history in early December when they appointed Dr. Marion Bowler as their Justice of the Peace. This is a first in Canadian First Nations history. Dr. Marion Bowler has nearly 40 years of legal expertise. She was the first Indigenous woman to be appointed provincial court judge in BC in 1994. Chief Robert Louis is from the West Bank First Nation and chairman of the First Nation Lands Advisory Board. This is an organization that works across Canada, supporting First Nations communities in re-establishing control over their lands, natural resources, and the environment. Chief Louis spoke with journalist Heather Watson in Nanaimo, British Columbia, about what this could mean for the future of Comox and other First Nations across the country.
On December 4th, 2024, Comox First Nation appointed Dr. Marion Bowler as their Justice of the Peace, a first in First Nations history in Canada. This historic moment is the next step in a long journey for the Comox First Nation towards self-determination, building on previous steps like signing to the Framework Agreement in 2014 and voting to approve their land code in 2016. Chief Robert Louis of West Bank First Nation is chairman of the First Nations Land Advisory Board. The Land Advisory Board is an organization that works across Canada to support First Nations communities in their efforts to re-establish control over their lands, natural resources, and environment. One way is through land codes, a level of self-governance achieved by the Comox First Nation in 2016. Chief Louis spoke to CHLY about what it means to be a land code First Nation, how that led to this landmark moment, and what this means for the future of Comox First Nation, as well as other communities across the country.
Yes, a land code First Nation is a government decision maker. It has the community who passes a land code, enters the realm of self-government. The parts of the Indian Act disappear and is replaced by the jurisdiction of the First Nation. So at least one-third of the Indian Act is no longer applicable to a First Nation with a land code.
Louis explains that this means the community, in this case Comox First Nation, governs what happens on their lands with full lawmaking capacity.
Anything that affects lands, the community has that full decision-making capacity.
Comox First Nation is one of over 120 communities across Canada to pass land code with the help of the Lands Advisory Board, Louis says.
This is what is happening across the country, and I know our team We have lands board of directors that are reflective of communities right across Canada. We've got resource center staff who, you know, work from Vancouver Island right through to Newfoundland. And it's a really a good working feeling that, yes, we must work together. Don't leave anybody behind.
While Comox First Nation are one of many to pass land code, they are the first to appoint a justice of the peace. Louis shares what it is that qualified Dr. Marion Buller to be the first.
And Dr. Buller is a First Nation member of the Mistawasis Cree First Nation in Saskatchewan, and has achieved much in her career over 22 years as a provincial judge.
The Honorable Judge Marion Buller has nearly 40 years of legal expertise and was the first Indigenous woman to be appointed provincial court judge in BC in 1994. Judge Buller was instrumental in establishing the First Nations Court of British Columbia in 2006 and became Chief Commissioner of the National Inquiry into Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls in 2016. She was appointed Chancellor of the University of Victoria in 2022.
There's no doubt that they've made a perfect choice for their Justice of the Peace.
The movement to self-governance evolved from the framework agreement to the passing of land codes at the turn of the millennium. Since then, the number has grown to over 120 communities across Canada with this self-government land management function, including Comox First Nation. But the gap in enforcement persists, as Chief Louis explains.
So the difference here is that while you have the general public having more clarity on how enforcement takes place, how prosecution takes place with First Nations, it's a growing understanding with various levels of government to enforce those laws. So consequently, Comox has had to challenge the laws and ensure their laws are enforced.
Louis shares how that very thing happened with a landmark case in 2018.
And so they were very successful here in 2018 with a landmark case, court case on trespass, a landlord-tenant situation where their laws, once passed, had to be enforced by the courts and by the RCMP.
Louis says this gap in the system is what led the Comox First Nation to their decision to appoint a Justice of the Peace, the first ever in Canadian First Nations history.
They have expertise now. So now, for them, it means that they have a Justice of the Peace who can now deal with offenses and implement things like restorative justice. Here you have the potential of adding more of a traditional flavor to it, having elders circles in place, having sentencing that may be more unique to a community to reflect its own cultures and how they do things. Throughout Canada and BC, not excluded from that, there is a disproportionate number of incarceration of Indigenous peoples. And so it's helping to deal with things like that and blending in of the First Nation cultures in the justice system.
Louis says that as Justice of the Peace, Buller will have her hands full, setting the precedent for how things will be done and managing disputes and challenges to laws with fairness and efficiency, providing everyone their right to proper access to the justice system.
And so now she now provides a framework for that justice system to occur and to better reflect enforcement of Comox laws and values and how they wish to move ahead in the in managing their lands and resources.
Louis speaks as well to what it means for Comox First Nation and other communities across the country to have this historic first.
And I suppose when you look at being the first in Canada, they've put history in motion.
This is Heather Watson.
Please give a listen to Heather's complete and unedited 9-minute story on frequencynews.ca. That is where some 300 stories are produced every month by our team of journalists from all over the country. Well, we try. Questions or comments, radio at frequencynews.ca. And this is how we close our show this week. Thanks to our journalists, Heather Watson, Elizabeth Oakley, Rick Conrad, Adam Innes, Cora Cool, to both our national editors, Victoria Fenn and Conrad Fox, based in Ontario. Viewpoints is brought to you by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Local Journalism Initiative. I'm your host and producer, Boris Chassin. Thanks for keeping us company this week, and until the next, ciao.
Asia Apakamova in beautiful British Columbia, and you are tuned to Viewpoints.
You're tuned to Viewpoints, local news nationwide.
Welcome back to another episode of Plugged In My Ears. It's just Sam and Kyle joining you tonight for another episode. We've got lots of sports news. I think tonight we'll start off with the NHL. Sam, let's get started.
Yeah, well, I'm taking a bit of a different direction when we talk about NHL. I think we'll talk about the Four Nations Cup. We spoke about it either two episodes ago or last episode, and there is some criticism amongst us about what the Canadian D Corps looked like, and Kyle and I were just saying before we started recording, it's actually not that bad. And so I'll just go over the D Corps lineup right now that we have. Off the top of my head, it's Cale Makar. Then beside Cale Makar, it's...
We got Josh Morrissey.
Josh Morrissey as well. Well, even just Makar in general. Let's put this in perspective. This guy hasn't gotten a point in the last five games, and he's still number one in defense scoring. I don't know. He's pretty nasty. And I was looking at the 2005 lineup just to compare, which has really good players too. But let's consider the defensemen that they had. The 2005 roster was Chris Pronger, Rob Blake, Scott Niedermeyer, Dan Boyle, Adam Foote, Wade Redden, and Brian McCabe. Those guys are all really good, especially Chris Pronger and Scott Niedermeyer. But they do not compare at all to Cale Makar, in my opinion at least. But anyways, regardless, back to the defensemen. So Makar, Josh Morrissey, Colton Pareko, still a little surprised that he made the roster over Chychrun, but that doesn't really matter too much. Alex Pietrangelo, Travis Sanheim, Shea Theodore, and Devon Toews. That's actually not that bad.
That's pretty. Yeah, I was saying it's a good lineup. Shea Theodore is an excellent defenseman, and people have, you know, he's on Vegas, and Vegas tends to employ the let's just say the long term injury reserve quite often. And he's, you know, he's been one of their players that they've used that loophole on quite a bit. So he's definitely a bit of a sneaker pick there in the sense of when he's in the game, he is a very strong defensive player and a big playmaker too. He's not a big goal scorer, but he's an excellent playmaker.
No, and he doesn't really make a lot of mistakes either. People don't really notice this type of stuff, but 538 games played plus 72 is not easy to achieve. Not a lot of guys get that. And he's playing, on average, 20-ish minutes a game. I mean, just against New York the other day, he played 25 minutes. But I think that game went into overtime, so maybe that's why. But nonetheless, that's still a lot of ice time. That's a lot. And he's been pretty consistent his entire NHL career. I mean, he almost always plays a full season and gets around 45, 50-ish points. 50 might be a bit of a stretch. But even like thinking about it right now, his best season, from the looks of it, was his 2020-2021 season, in which he had 42 points in 53 games. And 41 games right now, he already has 33 points. And he's going to do better than that this season, too. So this is probably one of his peak seasons.
Oh, well, I mean, if he played, as I said, if he played all 82 games, he would be top five, likely, in defensive scoring. Right now, I think right now he's, like, top eight or something. So, he's an extremely good defenseman. And I mean, I think the team, you know, Team Canada roster coaching staff knows that. He's also got a cup, like he's a veteran as well, so he knows what he's doing.
But one thing that's kind of scary, if comparing rosters, the 2005 roster goaltending is Marty Brodeur, Roberto Luongo, and Marty Turco. And this year, Canada is what? Jordan Binnington, Aiden Hill, and Sam Montembeau. I'm sorry, but that is not one and the same. The goaltending has decreased significantly in this country over the last couple of years.
Yeah, I think it has to do with, I mean, part of it's actually a broader reflection of economics in Canada. I mean, like the inflationary aspect of hockey has been crazy over the last couple of years, especially. So, you know, goaltending has always been an expensive pursuit, to say the least. But with, you know, yeah, the economy not doing as well and inflation happening on a hockey gear, it's been really expensive to become a goalie in the last couple of years. So I think that's actually been probably the biggest factor.
Well, more than just that, let's put it into perspective for the viewer who doesn't really know or the listener. You can't really buy goalie pads anymore. Specifically, you can't really buy a goalie helmet. Every helmet is custom now because it has to be molded pretty accurately to the player's head, which makes sense.
Yeah.
But that's like $3,000.
Well, and another thing is that they have to, I think they've made it really strict because they're worried about head injuries. And
yeah, they did.
So you need to get one of these specific helmets. And since they've cornered the market on those helmets, they charge like these ridiculous prices, right? So it's because there's a bit more play with regular hockey helmets because there's just so many companies and they can't really get away with those kind of insane prices. But the hockey goalie helmets are a bit more niche, right? So it's
different. Yeah, they are. It's a bit weird. And even just a blocker is about $1,000. Trapper is another $1,000 or so. Pads are $2,000, $3,000. Chest protectors, $800. I mean, at that point, you're essentially making an investment. If it doesn't make the NHL, you're never getting the return on that one. So, yeah, that is a big reason. But then again, you know, other countries have good goaltending, like the United States has the best goalie in the NHL right now. I don't even think that's a question, really. Connor Hellebuck, he's insane at the moment. And that's going to be a bit of a problem for Canada to deal with, I think. But overall, not too shabby. But one thing I will say, Canada's offense is the best it's ever been. The 2005 roster, which is a really good roster for Canada, was Paul Kariya, Joe Thornton, and Jerome McGinnell on the first line. Now, you have to remember, at that time, Joe Thornton was the best player in the NHL, probably. The second line was Brendan Shanahan, who's no bad hockey player, Joe Sakic, Jason Spezza. The third line was Brad Richardson, Eric Staal, whose jersey was just retired in Carolina, and Marty Saint-Louis, the coach of the Montreal Canadiens now. And then the fourth line was Ryan Smith, Vincent Le Cavalier, and Shane Doan. And then Rick Nash was the extra forward. That's a really, really stacked forward lineup. But I just don't even think that really compares to Canada's current lineup. Like Sam Bennett, Anthony Cirelli, Sidney Crosby, Brendan Hagel, Seth Jarvis, Travis Konecny, Nathan MacKinnon, Brad Marchand, Mitch Marner, Connor McDavid, Braden Point, Sam Reinhart, Mark Stone. I mean, I'll just put it this way. Arguably, there are two guys who fit in the top five NHL players of all time on that offensive lineup.
Oh, yeah. No, our lineup's pretty stacked. You know, one player I actually might have said this last year. I thought that Wyatt Johnson was going to be having a breakout year this year.
Oh my God, I didn't even think about that.
But he didn't really have one, to be honest. I mean, Dallas has been kind of in this weird funk that they just haven't really gotten out of. They've been playing okay, but their offense hasn't been great.
Well, as evidenced by today, they lost to Ottawa 3-2.
Yeah, I mean, I totally thought Wyatt Johnson would end up on this team, but, you know, him and the Dallas Stars have been struggling a bit, so he didn't end up on this team. But I could see him. He's got a promising future. He was really strong in the playoffs last year. Especially when I watched him against the Oilers, he was a main factor in that game, those games, right? So, but yeah, I can see him being on the next Four Nations.
Yeah, probably. Sure. I mean, think about it. The next Four Nations Cup's going to have Bedard, Celebrini. Well, see how Bedard does, but Celebrini for sure. Oh, yeah. Bart Bedard will probably make it. Yeah, I should be talking so loosely about that.
No, you've got a bunch of good players that are for sure coming down the pipeline for sure.
Yeah, and then just in general, too, I mean, McKinnon's kind of surging in the NHL this year, 68 points. He's been pretty nasty for a while. I don't think that's any surprise to anyone. But, you know, like, he's played 44 games, 68 points. Okay, I guess he's almost on track to do as well as he did last year. Last year was probably his best year with that 140 points in 82 games.
Yeah.
Arguably, like, you could say that he's the best forward on the team. I don't know who's the best right now.
I think one of the best, I mean, I think his superpower on this team is the fact that he's got that synergy with Makar.
Yeah.
So that's a pretty wicked combo for this, you know, because there's a couple players that are going to end up together that are really, you know, really good players together on the same team, but I don't think there's any pair like that on Team USA, right? So.
No. Well, what is the lineup anyways for us? Like, who's on the first line, second line, third line, fourth line?
I'm pretty sure. How do you decide? I thought Crosby's on the first line.
Well,
center. Crosby has the most face-off wins in NHL history. Not a bad center.
No, not a bad center at all. But I mean, like, I just don't know who you put on the first line. Like, he's pretty interchangeable with McDavid and with McCarr. Or no, McCarr, sorry, McKinnon.
Yeah. Like, I mean, I think that the first line is more interchangeable. I'd be more curious about, I guess, who gets power play spots. Obviously, McKinnon, McCarr, then McDavid. I'd say probably Sam Reinhart as well.
I think Crosby will probably find his way onto that too.
Then potentially Crosby, yeah.
But you know, you could also put Mitch Marner on that, or you could put Brad Marchand. Brad Marchand doesn't mind sitting in front of the net for a while, but Sid's better at tipping the puck. Yeah, it's just even Braden Point. He's got a crazy shot.
Braden Point. Yeah.
Like, yeah, this is. Yeah, I don't know. It'll be interesting to see. Although I gotta say, I'm not really too concerned about other teams that much. I think I was more concerned last time. When we talked about it, especially because I thought the Americans were pretty legit, but I don't actually think they're that legit. Matthews is really good. Don't get me wrong. He's got a lot of points. And Charlie McAvoy is a really good defenseman. They got good goaltending, but.
I think Matthews needs some more stem cells to keep himself going. He's been struggling. Maybe, you know, if they're playing Four Nations in Germany, he might have a chance. But, you know, back in Montreal, we don't have enough. We don't have the stem cell access he needs.
No, we don't. That's exactly right. A bit of wild card activity going on, though, in the NHL. Colorado's in a wild card position. But, you know, Vancouver kind of is. Calgary's right behind them. Vancouver has 48 points, but one extra game in hand. Calgary has 47 points. It's pretty close. Colorado's got a bit of a lead. But the Western Conference seems pretty solidified to me right now. It looks like Winnipeg is going to stay in first place in the Central Division. Minnesota and Dallas probably will stay 1 and 2. Or 2 and 3, sorry. And then Edmonton's surging again. They might knock Vegas out of the number one spot of the Pacific. Although I think LA is kind of pushing their limit here to some degree. I just don't foresee LA.
Well, no, as I said before, LA is a very structured team and they know how to play 5-on-5 super well. And you know, they've actually, you know, with Brant Clark and some other new players on their team, their offense I think has gotten a bit better, maybe.
You know who's impressed me a lot is Quentin Byfield.
Byfield's been good. He's been due for a pretty major breakout for a while, right? He's been great.
Yeah, I think his breakout year is this year.
Yeah, he's been good this year. I mean, so they've got some good keys there, but I don't think they have the special teams to do too much in the playoffs. Like that's what's killed them against the Oilers. So they just keep playing the Oilers first round every year, right? And they get absolutely killed on the special teams. Like I think when they played the Oilers last time, they got shut out for every power play they had, and they got scored on for 50% of the power plays the Oilers had. So you're not winning any series with that. So, you know, if they can kind of figure out how to increase their scoring power on the power play, which would probably involve some trading. I mean, if they have some really good acquisitions in the trade deadline, maybe they'll get a bit stronger. But I think they got a lot of work to do still.
Yeah, they do. And in the Eastern Conference, or I guess division, really, I don't know what you want to call it, Eastern Conference. Right now, Boston is in the wild card spot with Columbus. Ottawa's 1 point out, but they have one extra game to play. Columbus is just ahead of them with 46 points. Ottawa's been doing pretty good recently, but the team people are sleeping on is Detroit. Detroit's won the last 7 games straight, and they haven't played an easy lineup either.
No, I mean, Detroit had some a weird start to the season. Like they've actually got a pretty stacked roster. Like they had made some major acquisitions. They got DeBrincat that they brought on, you know, recently.
Patty Kane too. I think people just kind of forgot this guy was on the roster.
Lucas Raymond has been excellent.
Dylan Larkin's still there too.
Larkin's very good. They've got a lot of good players. Cam Talbot actually in net has been playing pretty well too.
Tarasenko's also there.
Yeah. No, they've got a strong lineup.
I think their weak point's actually their defense.
No, like Jeff Petrie is a very good defenseman. Moritz Seider is one of the best defensemen in the league.
Mm-hmm.
And Sherratt is, you know, has ups and downs, but
yeah. But anyways, those guys could be pretty legit pretty soon.
I was surprised they weren't doing well earlier on. I mean, they're just kind of figuring their things out. I wouldn't be surprised. You know what, if I had to make a bet on it, I'd probably say that they'd get a wild card spot for the playoffs.
I'd say they got a chance. I think they might kick Ottawa out of their spot.
Last year they were 1 point away from wild card spot, right? Uh-huh. There was a three-way tie between Pittsburgh, Washington, and Detroit. Mm-hmm. And Detroit beat them, or sorry, Washington beat them out by that 1 point, and they won that their last game. But so super tight.
Mm-hmm. Well, based on looking at their lineup, sorry, not their schedule is what I meant to say. They'll probably beat San Jose on Tuesday when they play them. The Panthers, though, that might break their winning streak on Thursday. And then they all have to go right back and play Tampa, and then they have to play Dallas. That is three difficult games to play. But they got a really busy month. They only have a few days off. Like, they play today, day off tomorrow, play Tuesday, day off Wednesday, play Thursday, day off, then play Saturday, then Sunday, back to back.
I've never
both heard away it. Games. Yeah. Tampa to Dallas. That's not easy. Then day off, then against Philly, away again, then day off, then at home against Montreal, then day off, then Tampa, then day off, then LA, then 2 days off, and then Edmonton. That closes out the month.
Yeah. I mean, I've never heard of 8 games in 2 weeks. That's a lot.
Yeah, that is a lot.
You can't do more than that, but that's a pretty crazy schedule.
Yeah, no, that will not be easy to work with. But something we were discussing the other day too, it's a little bit unrelated, but just an update because for some reason it popped in my mind. We were talking about how the NCAA has changed its regulation to let Ontario Hockey League players, QMJHL players, WHL players go on to play with them afterwards, and how we were talking about how that affects U Sports. Well, U Sports is actually depleted now. Most of the guys who played Major Junior in U Sports have all committed Division I. And so I think U Sports hockey might actually be coming to an end in terms of its competitive element.
I think it was in a weird spot before because it was like overly competitive given that it didn't get much spotlight on the hockey stage, mm-hmm. The NHL wasn't really pulling from university teams that much. Like once in a while, I know the Vancouver Canucks called up, or sorry, the Oilers called up UBC goalie once, mm-hmm. as a backup and stuff. Like it happens, but it's not as integrated really. Whereas the NCAA has the young players, like the prospects that are playing in it, right? So that really changed things. I think this is going to restructure D1 hockey completely.
I just kind of see a huge investment, no?
I think the reason why the NCAA did this is because it'll make the hockey quality much better, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Will they have as many prospects in the NCAA? I feel like no, actually. I feel like a lot of prospects are going to stay and get more experience in the CHL, and they might commit NCAA when they're like in their 20s.
Yeah,
but I feel like there's gonna be less people that commit D1 at 18 and stuff. I think it's just gonna be way less common.
I think the age of having guys who are NHL ready playing in the NCAA is over. I think what's gonna happen is guys are gonna go play in the CHL, get drafted, and then if they're ready before they have to go play in the NCAA, they'll just go.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's going to be the way it was before, where guys would wait till they're 23, 24,
yeah,
and go play in the NHL.
Like there'll be a lot more. I know that I'm pretty sure the NCAA has more lax rules on age.
They do. You can be up to 29 years old and play D1.
Yeah,
you can. Whereas U Sports, you can't be older than 25.
And I think that U Sports is also pretty strict with eligibility years, so you get 5. And I want to say that the NCAA is similar, but I know there's a lot of loopholes that are used. Like if you in U Sports, if you get injured, the year still counts. Like if you've played even one game, it still counts as a year of eligibility. I think in NCAA that doesn't work like that. So
no, it's a bit different than NCAA. You can get redshirted at any point during the year. That means your entire year is annulled, essentially.
Yeah, so like I've heard stories of like a football player that got redshirted, like, you know, for a couple extra years. He's playing on the football team for like 7 years or something, right? So definitely different ball game. But I think the good thing is that it's going to make the CHL quite a bit more competitive, especially in terms of young players. There's going to be a lot of young players that come from the States and other countries to the CHL. I mean, a lot of people already do that, but I think even more, because there'll be more incentive to play in the CHL instead of just playing NCAA.
Yeah, exactly. I think the CHL just simply will become the premier league for development.
Yeah.
It will be where all the best players in the world who are young go to play, so long as they can do that. Which it kind of was to some degree. I mean, I think it was hard to turn down the OHL. The one thing that's kind of annoying, though, is if you play in the WHL and you play for a team like, I don't know, say you play for Winnipeg and you have a game in Victoria, that's not an easy bus ride. And teams aren't allowed to fly. That's a rule in the CHL. You have to take the bus everywhere. The only exception actually is the new QMJHL team in Newfoundland and St. John's, because you just can't really take the bus from St. John's to anywhere else. But yeah, it's it's definitely going to make everything better. I just think it's going to destroy the USHL to a large degree.
Yeah.
These good hockey players aren't going to go there anymore. They're going to get...
Well, there's a weird situation. So the American Hockey Association blocked the joining of two USHL teams to the CHL, the OHL, actually.
Oh, that was recently, right? Yeah.
Yeah, they blocked it. I mean, I think because they're... It makes sense to have it integrated, but the problem is it would only be the northern states that that's possible. Like, you can't really have, like, a southern state integration with the CHL. That's just, like, way too... I mean, I guess you have a separate divisions, but then, I don't know. It's complicated. The network and the teams are well-established in Canada. I think the USHL was just never going to be able to really compete with that just because of how, you know, well-established the teams are in Canada. And, I mean, the crowds are great and stuff. Like, so there's just a lot more money in it. But it makes sense to have potentially in the future. I think it's gonna be inevitable, actually, that there's some USHL, like some US teams that get integrated into the CHL.
And there already are a few, like Saginaw, Flint, Michigan.
Mm-hmm. But I was saying like a more
wider, you're right. It'll become wider. I think it's just gonna take time because part of it too, you have to convince the Americans that they'll still make money off of this.
That's
a really big.
The other thing is you got to work out the distances, right? So if, you know, it complicates how the league works because they're already pushing the limits with some bus trips, but. If you can justify some of the northern states maybe having one or two teams out there, I think that I could see that happening.
Yeah, it'll be a bit difficult to connect teams in Alaska to the CHL. I think that's one thing, which actually is good for. So in the US, the way it works is that the USHL is kind of like their version of the CHL. And then the next best league is called the NAHL, the North American Hockey League. Then there's the NA3HL, which is kind of like their farm teams. And then the NCDC, and then there's a bunch of other leagues, which, quite frankly, one should avoid because they're kind of predatory. But I think that if the USHL gets absorbed, which it likely will, the NAHL will become the new best junior A league in the States, which actually is better because it's so much less driving and distance to cover, and it's not really going to change too many dynamics. Like, that league's caliber is going to stay the same because those guys would have never gone to play in the USHL anyways. So that might actually just give Canadians more opportunities to go play junior A if they can't make junior A teams in Canada. And the US also has different regulations too. Like, they don't care where you're from. If you got money, you can play. In Canada, every junior A roster has to be about 75% Canadian, which is also a unique thing. And so that's one thing too that the American Hockey Association may not like, is that if we absorb all these American teams, 75% of their players, if it's a Canadian league, still have to be Canadian. So that's a bit of a conflict of interest too. And I'm sure it's going to get dropped to more like 50. But if they get dropped to 50, I mean, the Americans also have to remember they're competing against the Swiss, the Swedish, the Germans, Austrians, Finnish.
I think it would still rest at around 50 or more naturally anyways.
Because, I probably would. There's just more people play hockey in Canada.
Well, the NHL itself is a bit over 50% Canadian. Yeah. So, I mean, that tells you. But with the actual number in the CHL, probably be a bit higher than that even, but would just naturally be at anyways. I think it's also... These changes are actually reflective of there's been a lot of growth in hockey in the last couple of years, I'd say. I mean, props to the marketing teams and stuff. Like, they've been able to, I think, grow the sport quite a bit. I don't actually know the exact numbers on this, but I think it's interesting relative to other sports that have been struggling quite a bit. Like, the NBA has been hammered with some really bad ratings last couple of years, and they've been actually struggling with viewership numbers and everything. So... I mean, it's at least promising to see that NHL is kind of, you know, growing a lot and relative to other sports that are having, I guess, some struggles.
Well, I'm not terribly surprised that the NBA is struggling. Watching an NBA game is probably the most boring thing of all time. By the end of the first quarter, the game is kind of decided every game.
Well, no, I mean, part of what happened to the NBA, and I mean, I think there probably will be some major rule changes. But for the longest time, or at least it's been especially abused now, especially with so much catering of specific specialized players that are three-point shooters, like experts. Defense is kind of eroded.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the number of three-point shots that are sunk every night has, like, tripled or quadrupled over, like, the last couple of years, right? Like, and it's kind of changed the game so much not to say make it less competitive, but it has definitely altered the structure of the game in the sense that there's less defense being played. And there's almost like this like easy scoring that's happening, like, because the 3-point line is probably too close. Like, they almost need to move it back.
They're almost out of bounds if they do that,
though. Yeah. I mean, to try to make the game a bit more competitive again, right? Because if you've got, you know, Wembanyama from the, you know, point shooting, and he's, you know, 7'5", there's no, you can't really guard him, so the defense doesn't even try. He just sinks 3 points, like, all, you know.
Yeah, it just makes it less entertaining, right, I guess, right? Less aggressive.
So yeah, they need to restructure the rules a bit. And yeah, then that might bounce back some viewership. But I think it also just shows the resiliency of the NHL, right? Because that's, you know, that issues that the NBA is having with rules is also paired with low arena attendance. And there's some that, you know, that's also reflective of some economic struggles in North America. But the fact that NHL has kind of been able to
survive that.
I mean, survive that and increase viewership is pretty impressive.
Yeah, it is impressive. And I think people also just enjoy the speed of the game. Hockey's a fast game. It's entertaining. There's lots of big hits. There's a few fights. Not that many anymore. But there's enough fights to capture the minds of the younglings who aspire to be boxers with skates. I agree. The resiliency of the NHL and their strategic...
You can look at what they've done, right? Like, so the NBA is struggling with rule changes, right? But the NHL realized they had problems. Like, overtime was way too long. We can't play 2-3 overtimes with 5-on-5 in a regular, you know,
season game, yeah.
Regular season game. And the, you know, NHL has been making tons of rule changes. Like, they've been switching up the overtime rules right away. Like, and they just,
well, the 3-on-3 was a brilliant decision instead of 4-on-4.
That made the game more exciting. Like, I love the 3-on-3 rule. That's way better than watching 5-on-5 overtime in a regular season game. And it's made the games way shorter, so people watch the whole game. There's stuff like that. Like, that was a change that they implemented overnight, but pretty quickly, right? And they've been doing other small little tweaks here and there.
Yeah, and I think they've done a good job with their World Series too. I think they're hitting the mark pretty well. Football, the NFL kind of does it better in some ways, but also the NFL really chooses where they go. Like, they go to England. England's a pretty big football base, but the NHL, I think, actually has a bit more sway internationally speaking than the NFL does. It's in odd ways, it's more accessible. And that, I don't really know how it's more accessible. I think there's just more pull towards hockey. Maybe that's just because there's ice in more places. But those NHL World Series games sell out really fast. Amazing attendance, and the amount of fans who come back here to watch games afterwards is really, really high. And I think that when they started going to Scandinavian countries, but then also Central European countries, that was the smartest decision they could have done. Because when they went to Australia later, that worked out really well too. And I think it's because of all the hype that happened there, made them believe, like, yeah, it's not just a North American thing. This can be a world sport also. The only issue that the NFL has is that they've only really done their World Series in England. But I think a lot of the world sees England and the United States kind of as, you know, one in the same coin, which it is, to be fair. They do share that same cultural history. But it just makes it easier for hockey to translate to the rest of the world when we go to countries that really don't share that much in common with Canada and the United States, specifically like Czechia. Like, I mean, you know, as much as the Czechs and the Canadians share some things in common, like our shared alliance war in World War I and II, it's about it, really, you know.
I mean, they're definitely separated by a bit of landmass there, and they've definitely taught us a couple lessons in hockey in the last 2 years. But
certainly so. Well, I mean, yeah, big time. Big time. Well, also, you know, Czechia now is like a great repertoire of players too. Mm-hmm. I think some of the greatest NHL players are Czech. I mean, Jaromír Jágr is one of the best examples, but Chara was Czech as well, though he was born in Slovakia, which is kind of confusing. But I guess it's kind of how that works. And the list continues. But I think this is Czechia's next 10 years of hockey. They have so many good young guys coming up that are pretty fast. The only thing is, I just think that they still play a bit too much of a European style of game to translate over to the NHL nicely. I don't know if you caught on to that in the World Juniors at all, but you could clearly tell which kids played in North America and which ones didn't.
Yeah, I mean, Czechia had a bunch of guys that played in NCAA, and one player that played in the AHL. So, I mean, they had some mixed backgrounds, but yeah, they played a more traditional style with big defensemen that, you know, pummeled the offense, the defensive zone, and tried to kind of physically outsize the other team and just manhandle a little bit, and it tends to work. But yeah, they had some good scoring too, so they were a pretty well-rounded team, actually.
They were indeed. But on that note, I think that's about all the time we have for today. Thank you for joining us on Plugged in My Ears, and we'll be back next week with another episode.
With the colder months coming up, we're all using more natural gas in our homes. While it's a reliable and safe energy source, it's super important to keep safety in mind. If you smell something weird, like rotten eggs, it might mean that there's gas.